So thanks for tuning into the podcast. And before we get started, this is the Cub Podcast, which we have on here with Kyle Reichert and Sam Fels. But there's also the Movie Deep Dive Podcast with Mike Pusateri you can listen to on this feed. And Remember This Crap with Mike Donahue. Donahue and I just did one on the 2009 Cubs. If you remember Milton Bradley and Kevin Gregg, you remember the 2009 Cubs. And the most recent Movie Deep Dive is Rounders, but we have a special one coming up in the next couple of days that has to do with the NFL draft coming up next week. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. And as always, you can sign up for the subscription newsletter at pointlessexercise.com. Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to do the Cubs podcast. And with me is Kyle Reichert. Sam Fels is on assignment. Or he tells us. Who knows where Sam is. But he's not here today. So you're just going to two people complain about the Cubs instead of three. Kyle, how are you doing?
Doing all right, Andy. How are you?
Good. So the Cubs are off to a, at least as we're speaking, to a 7-9 start. Although it looks... fingers crossed, like it might be 8-9. They are fortunate that they are in a, which we knew, they're in a division of crap, where the teams that are good at one thing are not good at the other. And so if you are of the belief, I'm not sure that we are, that the Cubs are actually better than they've played so far, they have not dug a hole so big that they won't be able to get out of it. However, if they're not good, it doesn't matter how deep the hole is. They wouldn't be able to get out of a puddle. So, so one of the things that was kind of fun, it was amazing given the source, Jesse Rogers tweeted out on Wednesday a projection of Javi Baez's weird stats to start the season. If he just did exactly what he's done over 162 games, Javi, who is currently or coming into tonight's game, hitting an even 200 with, let's see, how many total hits did he make? 12 hits, 2 doubles, 4 homers, 12 RBIs, 5 stolen bases. He has struck out in more than half of his at-bats, 31 strikeouts in 60 at-bats. And according to Jesse's math, which is always a little sketchy, over 162 games, Javi would obviously hit 200, but he would hit 40 homers, he would steal 50 bases, he would walk 10 times, and he would strike out 313 times. I believe the record is like 210, maybe? So he would obliterate that record. So when I ask you, Would it just be fun to see that?
Oh, I think it absolutely. I mean, we gotta cheer for something. You may as well do an Allie Ellen and cheer for history when it presents itself.
That's right. Yeah. If you can't see Tom Glavine win his 300th game against you, you want to see Abby strike out 313 times. It's basically the same thing.
Pretty much.
Yeah, we had that. The story last week when the Cubs were on Sunday Night Baseball, which I'm not a fan of any part of that. I don't like Sunday Night Baseball, period. I don't like when the Cubs are on it because it screws up my weekend. And Buster Olney reported that in spring training 2 years ago, 2020, right before everything got stopped for the pandemic, Javi turned down a $180 million contract from the Cubs. And it immediately smelled like, the report smelled like bullshit to me. Not that he didn't turn out a contract, because we know that he did. They were negotiating, and so, well, presumably, the Cubs actually made him an offer. it just seems like had the figure been out there, we would have heard about it by now, and it wouldn't have taken little Buster to be the guy who broke the story with $180 million. What it felt like to me was the Cubs leaking to Buster. You know, hey, look how much Javi's struggling. We tried to pay him $180 million 2 years ago, and he wouldn't take it. So if he doesn't sign with us, it's not our fault. We tried. And I just have a hunch we're going to get a lot of those kind of rumors over the next few months as the Cubs brace themselves for letting guys go or trading them away and having fans be pissed.
Oh, they're absolutely coming. You almost have to give the Cubs a little bit of credit for trying the way they did instead of doing it through Buster instead of pumping it through Marquis, like when Marquis tried to tell us how great the Yu Darvish return was.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be, you know, the big that's the big sticking point for them about having a completely team-controlled network to turn out bullshit like that. So, I mean, I guess they tried a different approach. But, yeah, I mean, it's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Well, to me, that's a condemnation of Marquis to the point they're like, no, we need to release this to an outlet that so people actually see it and hear it. If we do it in Marquee, though, there's like 12 people that are going to know this happened. But, you know, poor little Bruce Levine. I mean, isn't that his sole purpose in life is to repeat Tom Ricketts and Crane Kenny rumors? They went right over him. That's terrible.
Yeah, I guess mouthpiece for ownership doesn't pay like it used to, which I guess could be taken a couple different ways, but for our buddy Bruce, you know, it's a tough one.
So the Cubs are in the series that we're recording this playing the Mets. So it's Javi Baez against Francisco Lindor. And Lindor just signed a contract for 10 years, $341 million. So the $341, no accident, considering Fernando Tatis signed a $340 million contract. Lindor got $341 million. When you watch the two play in this series, it kind of looks like if Francisco, like he might be worth $340 million more than Javi. Because, like, well, Javi, we could pay you $1 million if you're going to strike out 313 times. Javi may actually ask for $1 million to strike out.
At this rate, it'll be far better than anything he'll get on the open market, which, like, the other side of it, too, is, like, say things, you know, stay kind of status quo or maybe dip south a little bit with the team this year. But, like, who the hell's giving anything worth a shit for this version of Javi?
Yeah.
Like, you're talking about, like, trading guys every year, so.
Oh. Yeah, and normally it wouldn't, and maybe it's not. I mean, the reason it feels worse this time than normal, because Javi always goes through this. It's amazing that this many years into his career, he still goes through these long, prolonged stretches where he's like, "Fuck it, I'm pulling everything," and then he just strikes out, and it's terrible, and then magically he stops. And he goes on, he gets as hot as he was cold, and he makes up for it. I think the reason it feels worse this time is it never happened last year. I know it was only 60 games, but he was bad all year. And now he's been bad all year so far. And so the benefit of the doubt we would have given him in, you know, 2017, 18, or 19, it's hard to give him that benefit because this has gone on for a long time. And it's like, look, if it's as easy as you trying to go the other way once in a while, why do you have to be fucking reminded of it like five times every season? How does that not like take a game or like, oh, God, all right, today I got pull happy. I tried to yank everything. I'm not going to do that tomorrow. It's like he has to do it for 40 games in a row before he finally realizes that he's doing it.
And especially when, like, it shouldn't be that difficult for him to either think back or look back to his near MVP 2018 season or any other time in his career, and he's been going as good as he can. Like, it shouldn't be that hard to just do that. Maybe not to the extent, but at least have the approach.
Well, yeah, because he was great in 2018. And he was really good in 2019 until he fucked up his foot. And then the Cubs just had him keep playing with it. And then at one point, then he, I think he hurt his hand, right? And they,
oh, yeah.
So they finally took him out of the lineup, and they took a look at his foot finally. Like, oh, God, that's bad. It's like, yeah, we've been watching him limp for like a month, guys. I don't know what the copay is on their medical insurance, but it must be really high because they just don't even want, they don't want to send anybody to the doctor. No, no, we can't afford that.
Well, they're probably, they might have brought their premium down a little bit tonight. I don't know if you saw the broadcast earlier. They covered up more of the left field wall with more padding after Bryant hit his knee the other week or whatever.
The brilliant, you kind of question the guy who installed the padding in the first place. You know, he's over there putting it up, and he's like, wow, this just right at knee level. It turns back into cement. Ah, I'm sure it'll be fine. Yeah, the weird thing about it, I thought, was it was kind of a nice look with the dark brown pad and then the concrete top. All they did was put more dark brown pad on top. Why didn't they use like a taupe or a beige and kind of mimic the look that was there? You wouldn't even know. It would look just like the stuff going up the wall, or the wall slants up on its way out to the bleachers. You know, usually the Cubs are pretty, if they're not good at everything, they usually are pretty good at aesthetics. But maybe it's just a bitch to keep clean. I don't know. But even if you look right now at the, this is really good to do on an audio-only podcast. Not only am I pointing at something, but I'm pointing at something that's on TV live while we're watching it, not when you're listening to it. But the little rotating ad boards behind home plate, they have a pad on top, and it's beige or whatever to match the concrete. Why didn't they do that on the new pads that go up the side?
It would have made too much sense.
Yeah, they probably had, somebody had a shitload of dark brown vinyl left over, and they're like, oh, we're gonna have to use this. So I mean, I think a long-term frustration with Javi, I mean, for me, is he's always a great player outside of the batter's box. I mean, I don't think any player in baseball impacts a game when they're not in the batter's box more than Javi. He's a great defensive player. He's a ridiculous, instinctive base runner. And so you put up with the weird swings of hot and cold at home plate. But it just felt like for a long time, if he would simply be open to shortening his swing and simplifying it, he'd still hit 40 home runs, but we wouldn't have to put up with him hitting 189 for a month at a time.
He absolutely would, and the frustrating part is, like you were saying, he's done it before. He's literally done it. Like, he's shown it. Just, you can, you know, get the foot down or whatever and go the other way. That's when he's at his best, when he's, you know, going to both parts of the field and driving the ball into the gaps. I mean, and he can do it. He just feels like he chooses not to sometimes almost.
I mean, what I'd like to see from Javi is when he gets in a slump, I wish the way he got out of it was for like three games, he's just going to bat left-handed. It's like, all right, my right-hand swing's fucked up. I'm just going to bat left-handed for three games. And then I'll just go back to right-hand later. Maybe I will reset myself. At least that would be fun. It's just like I always wanted them to let Yu Darvish at least pitch an inning left-handed. I just wanted to see it. I mean, he throws on one of his non-throw days between starts, he goes out and plays catch left-handed. And they claim he can throw, like, in the high 80s, easy, left-handed. It's like, all right, well, let's see it then. I mean, you're supposed to, this is the entertainment business. Maybe the Padres will do that, I don't know. Probably not. So, I don't want to just pick on guys who are struggling, but I'm going to, at least with this next one. So, Jock Peterson came pretty close to winning the Cactus League MVP. He was amazing. Nobody could get him. Nobody could get him out. And there was a concern that he left all of his hits in the desert. And it pretty much looks like he did. Jock is slashing a cool, and this is in 16 games. So, I mean, it's a tenth of the season. But, oh, that's why Jesse could do the math. I didn't realize that. All you had to do is put a zero behind all the numbers, and you pretty much get to 162. That's how he could do it. It's the only time all year he could have done that math was today. Okay. Now I feel better. Jock, 137, 262, 235. He has struck out 20 times in 51 at-bats.
And I won't even make you do the splits against lefties, but I mean, does he have?
I just assume it's face? I don't even want to look it up. I'm just going to assume he doesn't have a single hit against the lefty.
I mean, who could have seen that coming, that the guy that's a career, whatever he is, 180, 190 hitter against left-handed pitching wasn't going to magically start hitting left-handed pitching at age 28 after 6 years in the show?
Yeah, and the most frustrating thing about it wasn't that they signed him. I mean, he's kind of laying out there, spring training about to start, and he wasn't terribly expensive, which is that's the Cubs' bag. They're very excited about that. They knew their outfield, at least their corner outfield. They had two guys who couldn't start them against left-handed pitchers. You just can't. Jason Hayward has proven that he's not going to hit left-handers. But now he hits right-handers, so that's fine. Just don't play him against lefties. And then Jock was the same thing. So the team literally has one extra outfielder on it, which makes it kind of hard to cover two spots. But they have a brilliant answer, and they're using it tonight. So you play Jake Mariznick at center. Jake can't hit, but you know that's fine. Happ goes to left. Chris Bryant goes to right, and the great Matt Duffy is playing third base.
I mean, anytime you can get a lineup with Jake Mariznick and Matt Duffy, you have to do it.
All right. So Jock's numbers against lefties are actually this year a lot better than I thought they were. He's 1-for-13 against lefties. And he must have a sac fly against them because his splits are, he has an .077 batting average, but a .143 on base and an .077 slug. So that's great. Nobody could have seen that coming. It was completely mystifying that the guy who's never hit lefties wasn't going to be able to hit lefties. No. But that's fine. At least, you know, you got to have Eric Sogard and Matt Duffy on your team. So that's great.
And even though he's not with us tonight, presumably he's still alive, but he's not with us tonight. Sam's prediction from the last podcast about the articles that were going to be spewed out and the content in general about this team somehow being competitive, he absolutely hit the nail on the head with Brett Taylor over at Bleacher Nation on opening day. And a focal point of that article was Jock Peterson and Zach Davies being upside guys that, you know, could potentially be tolerant or decent enough to the point where they're candidates for extensions beyond this year. So, and we're all seeing how that's going. So,
yeah, that was the point for that one. I may have got Brett mad at me because I, during the last fiasco of Zach Davies' start, I went for and found the tweet that he sent about something like, "Call this may look crazy in 2 years, but I think I wish the Cubs could get a 5-year extension done with Zach Davies right now." And then I just retweeted it with 2 years with a question mark because it took like 2 weeks to look completely crazy.
And anytime you can lock up a guy who's never going to command a huge salary for 5 years without needing to, you apparently have to.
Well,
you have to
get I'm so glad that the Cubs signed that deal with David Bote when they did that, the 5-year, $15 million deal. Because with his great production, you wouldn't want to be going year to year with him and renewing him at $400,000. It's much better to be paying him $3 million a year because he's so worth it.
Well, he had a walk off grand slam that one time.
I think the problem with Bote is, I would guess it's mandatory in the Cub offices that the TVs have Marquee on it all the time. And they only have, other than the Prevagen and the herpes medicine commercials that they show, they have like 3 internal commercials that they show over and over and over again. And one of them is Bote hitting the walk-off grand slam. And so if it's like, it's basically like, it's brainwashing isn't the right word, but you know, these guys in the office are they're hearing this subliminally, hearing all day the David Bote thing. I'm surprised they haven't tried to rework like a 10-year, $150 million contract with him. That's probably coming next.
Speaking of Marquee content, I realized I saw on the broadcast tonight, I'm sure others have seen it before then, maybe that was the first night, but apparently they're doing Iowa Cubs games on Marquee this year.
They just announced that today. Yeah.
So
very exciting. And people are like, oh, good, we can see the prospects. It's like, no, not in Iowa. You're not going to see any prospects.
Yeah, what fucking prospects?
I mean, you're going to get to see, well, if, I guess if you consider Shelby Miller and Pedro Strop to be prospects, yes, you're going to get to see prospects. You are going to get to see Nico. And actually, this is probably the Cubs' reason for wanting to show them, is when Nico is hitting 247 in Iowa, and the fans are able to see it on marquee, all eight of them who are going to watch that shit, that may stop the clamoring for Nico. The problem with it is, if he hits 247, it's still going to be twice what Eric Sogard is hitting. So it's still going to be hard to justify that he's not with the Cubs. It's like, with 247, he'd be the Cubs' third best hitter.
He literally would be, which is the problem.
I was completely cool. In fact, I was worried they weren't going to do it. I think Nico really does need to go to Iowa and play, because he needs to be in a spot where he's going to get consistent at bats. He's got shit to work through. It's very clear. He's major league ready as a fielder. We saw that last year. He, through whatever weird metrics they used, he was a finalist for Gold Glove at second base. But he didn't get hardly any time above, I don't think he got any time above double A, and barely any at double A. He needs it. The problem wasn't sending Nico to Iowa. It was having David Bodie, Eric Sogard, and Matt Duffy as what you had on the big league team. It's like, you knew you were going to have to do this. You could have gone and gotten a real second baseman for the season on a one-year deal. They just didn't want to do it. And so that's what made fans were maybe mad about the wrong thing, but they were right to be wrong.
And I never totally got the service time angle on the Nico part of it.
Like, it's not a concern for him.
Exactly. Yeah. Was it part of it? Maybe, it will be, but like, yeah, he's not a guy that's going to be commanding anything that you're not going to be fine paying in 4 years or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if they had been worried about service time, he wouldn't have been on the active roster last year.
Yeah, right.
You know, because they didn't really, I guess they needed him in the late in games. You know, Jason Kipnis didn't hobble out to second base. You know, they could send an athlete out to go play there. But that seemed like a weird luxury to just have Nico up for the entire 60-game season. So that, to me, said they didn't give a shit about, like, they know he's not going to be a star. They're not going to worry about, oh, God, Nico's going to be a free agent a year earlier than we thought. I don't think that's going to be that big a deal.
No.
But the Cubs have had three guys who have hit, which is nice on a team of 26 players. They have three. One of them, relatively recent addition to the hitting, was Anthony Rizzo, which was nice to see. But Wilson Contreras, when not being hit, has hit. And Chris Bryant is hitting, which is nice. So last night, I was recording a podcast during the game, so I was doing exactly what I'm doing right now. I just look up. And there was a play where they kept re-showing it, and I couldn't figure out why they kept showing it. And I thought, oh, shit. Because it was the play where, on the replay, you see slow motion of Bryant running to first. He kind of chops his steps, and he steps over first base. Doesn't touch it. He just, like, steps right over it, runs up the line. And they kept showing it over and over again. And I'm like, oh, did he pull something? What did he do? But then I look up, and he's standing on first base. The reason they kept showing it was he missed first base, but Pete Alonso bobbled the ball, and the ump called him safe. He never touched first base. Alonso eventually stepped on the bag, but it was after Brian had run past the ump. He calls him safe, and the Mets couldn't challenge it because they'd already challenged a play and lost. So Bryant got to go to first base on a play where he literally didn't ever step on first base. But I've been so conditioned to him getting weird injuries running the bases that when I saw the replay over and over again without any context, I'm like, oh, shit. He didn't even make it through April this year. But thankfully, that was not what the thing was.
Well, they'll probably come out tomorrow and say he, tweaked something or whatever, and then
he anticipated stepping on the pillow, and he missed the pillow, as Flew LeBorg would say, and he shattered his kneecap in 18 places.
And he's going to play through until we do an MRI in 6 weeks and determine that his leg has been detached for the last month.
Oh, what's going to happen is he's going to get some weird injury they're going to make you play through, and then they're going to trade him, and they're actually going to get a good haul. And then the trade's going to get canceled because he's going to flunk his physical, and then they're not going to be able to get anything for him.
And the Cubs medical staff is going to be completely perplexed at the physical.
He looked fine to us. And they're like, he's missing a bone in his leg. What? We didn't see that on the X-ray. Wait a minute. I'm not sure we know how to use this machine. Like, yeah, I don't think you do.
It has been good to see him hit, at least, and he's had a couple of homers, I should say, that have looked like the vintage Chris Bryant.
Just the it's not, but because it's so fluid, it looks like he just takes the slow, easy swing, and it kind of looks like it's going to be right off the bat, like you know, he hit it. It's going to be a fly out to the left field, and then it's like bouncing off the video board because it just goes up and just continues to go. Yeah, he does hit. He hits very impressive home runs. It'd be nice to see more of them, but I've already braced myself for him leaving.
Yeah, we'll have to get some insight on how the ball flies in Atlanta or San Diego.
Yeah, and I will not. I mean, I would always tell myself this about, you know, when these Cubs go, I'm going to wish them well, but mostly I don't. A guy leaves the Cubs, and I'm like, all right, fine. I hope you fall down an open manhole, and you never get another hit. That won't be the case with Chris.
No.
I feel like the Cubs completely fucked that up from the very beginning, and he deserves to go somewhere else and continue to be good. Pitching-wise, it's been very impressive to see what I thought, and may still be, but I hope not, I thought it was the doomed return of Jake Arrieta. He was not good in Philadelphia, really, any of those three seasons. And he's like, well, you know, I had bone spurs, and I had something in my knee one time, and then they didn't have I couldn't do naked Pilates on the machine that they had. Everything was all goofed up. And I'm going to be great when I come back. And while he's faced the Pirates twice, and even though some of the other Cub pitching have pretended that the Pirates can hit, they can't. I believe he also got the Brewers. He also can't hit. And the Mets. But still, he's got a 2.86 ERA. He's only allowed 20 hits in 22 innings. He struck out 18, which I think is what he is now. He used to be like a well over a strikeout an inning. Now he's probably just a little bit under a strikeout an inning. And he's got 8 walks. So he has 28 base runners in 22 innings. It's not ideal. But he's been good. He's kind of passed the eye test. And I think the best thing about it is Ross seems to have, and it's easier, I'm sure. Jake's older and he's returned from wherever. But this idea that once the fifth inning passes, Jake's on notice. That you start to struggle, you're going to get yanked. So they may actually have something there.
Yeah, it's been fun to see him, obviously, and not surprised he's been, you know, throwing as well as he has, but for a guy, even with his age, for the shit he still has that moves all over the plate, like, he can still be effective, and he was always good at changing speeds, you know, even when he was in his prime, so, I mean, maybe he can keep it up and get them a nice 17-year-old foreign prospect with a nice frame in a couple months here.
Who have you got whose growth plates haven't closed yet? That's really what we're interested in. Do you have any of those guys? It's like, oh, for God's sakes. And of course, the big deal was they didn't bring John Lester back, and then they went and got Jake, and John Lester still hasn't pitched for the Nats, which that's not a great sign. He had to have half of his thyroid removed, then got COVID. So maybe that'll work out. Although, I don't know if you saw this. If you want, you could buy John Lester's house in Chicago for $6 million.
Ooh.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a house, there you go. It looked pretty nice, the pictures they had in the trib. I think the best story so far on the pitching staff is the renaissance of Craig Kimbrel, which actually, he was better last year for longer than most of us gave him credit for. He was so terrible his first four appearances that it like seared into your mind. He's done. This is horrible. It's embarrassing. But he had like I think after those first four appearances, players slugged 176 against him last year. That's, you know, that's like freakishly good. And he's been very good so far this year. I don't know what the slug would be. He's given up a single in 8 innings. So I don't think there's a lot of slugging going on with one total base in 8 innings.
They got him in the pitch lab.
They did. I mean, that's I love the pitch lab, and he's why. I mean, great stories like that. Yeah, he's striking out almost 15 guys per 9 innings. His last two appearances, though, he's got himself in trouble by walking guys, which he had not done in the first four. He was just literally blowing through lineups. The one troubling thing with him this year, which is not his fault, is he has twice now been asked to get more than 3 outs to get a save. And as much as we would all like to think that the Cubs are going to, you know, get back in this and contend, there's a fairly good chance, like 89%, that his value to them is in what he gets traded for. Because he's in the final year of his contract, like 15 of the 26 guys on the roster are. And if you get him hurt, dicking around trying to go more than one inning in April, that's not really going to help you in the long run. Also, pretty sure they have 9 guys in the fucking bullpen. There ought to be somebody who can get that 1 or 2 outs in the 8th so that Kimbrel just pitches one inning for you. Now, it's different if this was August and you were like balls to the wall trying to make the playoffs. Then absolutely. Throw it open. Go full Joe Madden. Have Kimbrel warming up in the 6th for all I care. But as of right now, the anticipation has to be that come July, you're fielding trade offers for him, not sending him out to get MRIs.
I'm not sure if the Cubs really know the difference when it comes to those two.
Yeah. I don't know. Another guy who has been really good, and this guy might actually be, well, I guess, I can't remember if they fixed him in the pitch lab or they just fixed him the old-fashioned way last year. I know he gave up a home run tonight, but Rex Brothers. This has got to be completely unsustainable. If I was Jed and somebody offered me like Taco Bell coupons for Rex Brothers today, he's yours. Go get him. Anything of value for this brief bout of competence from Rex Brothers, I would be selling him immediately. You know, Rex is not young. He's 33. He's been around for a long time. He hasn't been good for a stretch of more than a couple of weeks in like 6 years. So I would sell as high as possible, even if high is low. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, he's sporting a tidy 0.89 FIP and a 2.07 xFIP. So,
and he's,
really
and
shit, that'll play.
And he looks the part. Like, he throws hard. So, but I would.
He's accumulated 0.3 WAR this year, which is his highest WAR total since 2013. So, yeah.
Right, he's already more valuable than he's been in 8 years
combined.
And the Cubs have played. This is their 17th game. So, the bullpen, for the most part, has been good. Beady-eyed Dan Winkler. Came into a game and literally couldn't throw a strike against Pittsburgh, so that was funny. He loaded the bases, walked 3 guys. That was the 5-out save for Kimbrel. They had to just go right to him. The first 5-out save of his career, regular or postseason. Other than the one bad appearance, Andrew Chafin has been very good. And that didn't surprise me. I always liked him in Arizona. I always thought that's the kind of lefty reliever that the Cubs should find, because he's the rare guy who's tough against lefties like he's supposed to be, but not like a complete incompetent when there's a right-handed batter in the box. Although the Cubs used to specialize in the most perfect example of this ever was Mike Remlinger, who, when he was with the Braves, yes, he was left-handed, but Bobby Cox was smart enough to go, because he hates to throw his changeup, his best pitch against lefties. He was really good against righties and not all that great against lefties. The Cubs get him, and Dusty is like, he's left-handed. I got to use him against all these left-handed hitters. And couldn't understand why he couldn't get anybody out.
It's an easy game sometimes, Dusty.
The Alec Mills usage has been very odd, I thought. Ross had him close a game. They had the game where, it was just the other night, right, where Hendricks blew up. Yep. And they went right to Mills. And it's like, okay, I know he's the guy who's supposed to get you multiple innings in this situation, but he's not going to pitch the rest of the game, right? I mean, he's coming in the third. He's not going to pitch seven innings. You're going to have to use another reliever. So why not put somebody in between him and Hendricks? Somebody who actually can break a plane of glass with a pitch. Give the Braves a different look for an inning, and then go to Mills. Instead, they just brought him in, which was basically a worse version of the guy they were just hammering. And the Braves are like, yeah, did they even change pitchers? We didn't notice. But it's just, it's been really, Ross clearly loves him, and he will pitch him in any situation. In fact, he's in
right now. Yeah, I thought for a while that maybe it was the zig when everyone else zags, and instead of, you know, a hard throwing guy in the late innings, you bring in the guy that throws a 65 mile an hour curveball to, you know, keep them on their toes.
I don't know.
Has MVP candidate Ryan Tepera served his suspension yet, or is that still pending?
No, he's not. No. He was very vocal about, in a very weird way, basically saying, of course I threw at him, and how dare they suspend me? It's like, that's, maybe make a different argument. Just pretend that you didn't throw at him. But, MVP vote-getter, Ryan Tepera, not so much. We didn't see Dylan Maples forever, and he has been, but he's finally pitching lately. Well, not really. He's only pitched four times. But he's been every bit Dylan Maples. Seven innings pitched, 12 strikeouts, 8 walks.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, they are deathly afraid that, you know, because he has no options left. They're going to let him go, and he's just going to turn into a superstar for somebody else. I think it's time to take the risk. It's like, you know, if you won't play him, what good does it do you? He's just taking up a chair in the bullpen right now, basically. Let him go.
I mean, yeah, if it was ever a time or ever a season to figure out if you finally have something, I mean, you've been spinning your tires on the guy for legitimately 5 years, close to the big league level. Like, I mean, he might cost you your 79th win this year, so you got to settle for 78 or whatever, but may as well.
So Adbert made a couple of starts. He pitched well in one start and not so well in the other. And he is currently making $18 a day at the alternate site again this year. But this one makes sense. This is, they have to manage. They know they're only going to get about 100 innings out of him for the whole season. So they're trying to manage it as well as possible. So he is currently not there. They've had a lot of off days and they've been able to just kind of pitch around it. They had the weird Kyle Hendricks allergies flared up, and they had to put him on the COVID list because he had symptoms of COVID, even though he knew it was his allergies. So they've had to improvise lately with their starts. But thanks to that weird like 4-day period where they had 5 wins and they put 6 guys on the COVID list, we got to see Pedro Strop come back for 2 games. And his results were good. 2 scoreless innings. He struck out 3. It didn't always look great. But actually, I thought he's looked better both in the spring and now than I thought he would. I actually think if he's cool with shuttling back and forth to the alternate site, or whatever they do want. I guess Iowa may be the deal breaker for Pedro. When the AAA season starts, he might just be like, okay, fuck that. I'm not going to Des Moines. No. So we'll see.
It was fun to see him back, though. Debut. I think it was against the Brewers that clean, I guess, but somewhat eventful inning he threw.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, he's the numbers look fine. 2 innings, 3 strikeouts, 2 hits. Well, 2 hits, 2 walks, and 2 innings. That's a lot of base runners. But he managed to get outs when he needed them. As opposed to, so one of the other guys who came up because of the COVID thing, they were going to have to bring him up anyway because of the way they wrote his contract. But so all spring, we heard about, oh my God, where do you see Shelby Miller? The Cubs really have something with this guy. I know he hasn't pitched in 5 years, but, oh, he's rested and he's ready to go. And he came out his first outing, and he was charitably throwing batting practice. It was one of those where it almost wasn't good enough to be quality batting practice, and maybe that was going to work for him. But it wasn't good. He pitched.
Here's another WAR for you. He's at -0.1 WAR per Fangraphs this year, which is, if he just stopped right now, just stopped for the year, that would be his highest WAR season since 2017 at 0.4 for the Diamondbacks. He followed it up with 2 negatives in 2018 and 19, and I guess didn't pitch last year. So, yeah, his negative WAR is his highest in 4 years.
Yeah, he came in. His first game was April 14th against the Brewers. He faced 5 batters. He allowed 2 hits, 3 walks, 4 runs. He threw 23 pitches, 7 of which were strikes. Now, that also includes the 2 pitches that were hit. They may not have actually been strikes, but the Brewers were like, ah, fuck it, that's good enough. I would like a hit now. He came back then 3 days later and to pitch a full inning in their blowout win against the Barbs. They won 13-4 on Saturday and then lost 13-4 to them on Sunday. He pitched 1 inning. He faced 8 batters. So he actually got 3 of them out, but he also gave up 3 hits and 2 walks. But that brought his ERA down from infinity to 63. So things are looking good for Shelby. You can throw him on the pile with, Scott Baker from the Twins that they got? Drew Smyly, who they actually faced. These guys that they rehabbed, and then it just never worked.
I forgot Drew Smyly was I remember after I saw him, but I forgot he was still around. I didn't realize he was in Atlanta. But, yeah, he ended up getting thrown into the Cole Hamels trade, I think.
They traded him so that they could exercise. That literally was like the first sign that, oh my God, their finances are fucked. Because, that must have been 2019, between 18 and 19.
Yeah.
So in 18, they were still acting like a big market team. They let Jake go, but they signed you. And then they bragged that they got you at such a bargain that they were going to have money left over for next year to get additional pitching. Then during the season, they went out and got Hamels because they needed a starter. And then, so we were caught unaware when in that offseason, Theo was having to ditch salary so he could add any other players. And Drew Smyly he was the canary in the coal mine. He was our warning. Because he didn't have that big of a, it wasn't that big of a savings. It was like $7 million. Yeah. And they're like, oh, we had to do it or because they wanted to pick up Hamill's option. I think it was 20. And they're like, oh, we had to cut some payroll before we could do it. And it's like, ugh, that's great. How did you enjoy the Tony Walters era?
Man, I think the I have to make sure I'm at Wrigley when they hoist the flag in it. Maybe later this year or whatever.
Well, you'll be happy to know. This is shocking. They had to designate him for assignment. He cleared waivers. So he's at the alternate site. He's going to Iowa. They haven't lost.
That's great.
It's very exciting. Yeah, maybe the worst player in baseball. And the Cubs had to get rid of a player to keep him. That's great. That's where we are. I will admit, I don't believe I've actually seen, I know he's played, but I don't think I've actually seen Austin Romine in action yet. I'm sure it's majestic, but.
I don't believe I have either. I think did he start the day or the day game in Milwaukee after the
I think he did.
Wilson helmet?
We got to see Ildemar Vargas. He came back up for a day. That was fun. All these guys, they were so afraid to lose at the end of spring training. Everybody else in the league is like, what? No, you can keep him. We don't want any of you guys. You have a roster so thin that you have Eric Sogard and Matt Duffy on it. Anybody that you determine to be worse than them, no one is going to want.
And not just have them, but have them playing fairly significant innings.
I'm not sure. Did you know that Trevor Williams has a father? Had you heard that?
Does he know?
Yeah. This is Marquis' fascination with his dad is one of the oddest things ever. Interviewing him during games. I know they loved Mike Bryant, but I don't think we need more dads. But we got him.
I feel like we haven't heard from him for a while, Bryant, that is. Mike Bryant.
Yeah, I really miss him.
I don't want to jinx it. Probably due for a, fourth inning hit.
So when Marquee launched last spring, I think it was on the very first broadcast. It was at least on that first weekend. Taylor did, during the game, this is in-game, did a 7-minute interview with Mike Bryant. And they posted the whole thing on, Twitter, again, as if we really wanted to relive it over and over again. And it was like, oh, God, this is what we're going to get. So, we determined before you came on that you are able to watch the Marquee Sports Network. And so I want to ask you now, what is it, 3.5 weeks in, what do you think of Boog?
Boog, I think he's been perfectly adequate. I haven't been blown away by him. I think he's good. I thought he was good before, and I think he's good still now, which I guess is a fair, not bad assessment. I think he's been fine. The chemistry's not all the way there yet with JD, and it's going to take time. It obviously always does. Given, especially when you think back to some of the options that were floating around this past winter or whatever, I think it's gone and will go as good as we could have reasonably asked.
Yeah, I think I know I was concerned that it was going to be a disaster. Who knows who they were going to bring back or bring in. Yeah, I think Boog's been fine. And I know he's gotten some criticism because people think he hasn't been critical enough of the players during his first few weeks on the job. A, I don't really know that's his. I think that he has kind of a sensibility he shares with his friend, Len Casper. I don't think you're ever going to hear him just ripping players. But I also think even it's tough to, on your first month on the job, to get too critical of your new employers and their other employees. I'm going to guess, and if I'm wrong, that would be bad, but that if this continues, if the Cubs continue to not be good, Boog and JD will be far less diplomatic than they have been early on. I'm hoping.
Yeah, JD definitely won't be scared to speak out a little bit more.
Now, they still are insisting on ruining at least one, sometimes two broadcasts a week with the third man in, Ryan Dempster.
I thankfully have not caught any of those yet, and I need to try my best to keep it that way.
It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, they think he's great. I don't know what. Crane Kenny thinks that Ryan Dempster is just this super talent. And he's just not. He gives very pedantic analysis. And you've got JD sitting right there. You already have a pitcher in the booth. You don't need another pitcher giving you, like, poor man's Jim DeShays analysis when actual Jim DeShays is having to stop talk so that this asshole can. It doesn't make any sense.
Have they said when is Lou still going to do a broadcast or two this year? Because I could see that being fun for the first one.
Right. I can see it being fun for like a few innings. And then you're going to be like, okay, Lou, thanks. And I love Lou. I really do. But I have very low expectations that he's going to be good. I remember when he did between his time in Tampa and the Cubs, he was on one of the Fox postseason broadcast teams with and he got Steve Lyons got in trouble because he I don't remember what the whole context of it was, but he talked about Lou being Spanish or whatever it was, and then because I assumed he was Italian, but I think he's Italian and Spanish, and then Lyons made some weird thing about I'm gonna keep an eye on my wallet or something like during the broadcast. It was very odd. But while Lou was charming, he wasn't good. Like, he didn't tune in and be like, oh, God, this is great analysis. And he already does the thing just the way he talks anyway, which is not great in the booth. But, yes, supposedly he's going to do a handful of games as the third man. Doug Glanville's going to do a handful of games, and those actually should be pretty good. Mark DeRosa is going to do some. I think DeRosa's done one post game. I don't know. I literally... the Cubs had that the really cool win against Milwaukee when Wilson hit the two-run homer to give them the one-run lead, and then Kimbrel came in and, like, nailed down the save. It was the kind of game where you immediately want to watch the post game. Like, you just want it to last. You want the feeling to last for another half hour, and, you know, whether it was Cap and Holly or whatever, or even David DeJesus staring creepily at the camera and not saying anything with his mouth half open. And the Cubs post game started, and I just turned it off. Like, no, I don't give a shit what any of you guys have to think about this. It
hasn't been the same since Cap and Holly's giant Hulk fists in 20.
they're fisting each other after wins.
I haven't had the heart to tune into a Sox radio broadcast or an inning or two to check on Len. So
yeah, I haven't heard it either.
So he's doing.
So now, Len and I had this tradition where every year on opening day, I would send him an email. That it was always just the same email. The subject was good luck, and then when he opened it up, it said, "We're all counting on you." It's just the line from Airplane. And I was, the day of the Sox opener, I'm like, all right, fuck it. So I wrote him and said, good luck. And then I wrote, they're all counting on you. And he would just reply with, like, thanks or whatever. And this time he replied with, well played. And then, so that's it. I don't have any interest in, I don't watch Sox games. I don't want to listen to them. I don't care.
Yeah, I kind of want to just hear Len, see how he sounds on the radio. I'm sure he's doing great. He's great. But.
Yeah, I'm sure he's good. And he did TV the other day because Jason Benetti was doing an NBA game. In fact, he did the one where Jamal Murray from the Nuggets blew out his knee in like the last few seconds of the game. So he's supposed to do like 20 or 30 TV games, some with Stone, but also some where it's just him and Benetti. Those actually, I think, would probably be fun.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah,
but you'd have to watch the White Sox, which would be less fun.
Yeah, that would suck
for me. So, DeShays told the story, and I can't remember if I remember Mike and Donahue and I were talking about it last night, and I don't remember if we talked about it on the podcast or after the podcast. So, We've talked about it on the podcast. You're about to hear the same story again. But DeShays was telling a story about he had the Astros had given up on him, and maybe even, I can't remember if he went from the Astros to the Twins, but he was pitching in AAA for the Yankees, and they had a doubleheader, so they needed to call up a pitcher. So they called him up, and he was going to pitch the first game of the doubleheader. So he goes, I know I'm only going to spend one day at Yankee Stadium. I'm going back. But I pitched the first game, and I don't think he pitched terribly well. He goes, but I come out of the game, and I go take my shower. And then I go, because we've got a second game coming up, he goes, I go try to find the equipment guy. Because I need a uniform for game two. You know, my uniform's dirty, and I threw it in the thing. I need a uniform. And he says, the equipment guy's name was Mickey. And I'm like, hey, Mickey, I need a uniform for game two. He's like, yeah, whatever. I'll get to it. And he goes, first game ends. We have the break in between games. Guys are starting to warm up for game two. I still don't have a uniform. And I'm going around trying to get Mickey's attention. I'm like, I need a uniform for game two. And he goes, I never got one. He goes, I put my street clothes on and sat in the camera well next to the dugout. And so the funny part of the story was, the story was good, but Boog goes, wait a minute. He's like, when you were talking to the equipment guy, what were you wearing? And he's like, oh, I was just talking to him in a towel because I didn't have any clothes. And Boog, the camera's in the booth, and Boog just stares at the camera with his eyes like as big as he could. And so I thought that was funny. It was one of the, they should be a good fit with each other. They share a very similar sense of humor. The other thing that they brought back just recently, like maybe this week, you know, they have those awful keys to the game, apostrophe, oh, yeah. Q-U-E-E-S. And when they first did them, they didn't know where to put the apostrophe. They were putting the apostrophe between the second E and the S. It's like, what letters do you think you're leaving out? It goes before. But they had shortened those down to just like one thought. Well, now they're back to the three keys to the game. And they're letting DeShays go full pun with them. And actually, some of them are really funny. So I'm glad those are back. Because he's a genuinely funny guy. And I like when they just let him be funny.
He's good. They'll get better together, too. And talk about all counting on someone, like they might be our only hope in a couple months here.
So I don't watch much of the pre or post. But I do like to at least tune around. I like to hang in long enough to see who is on the post-game show. Because last year we got a lot of Sean Marshall and Ryan Sweeney. Now those are two electric personalities, just the guys you want talking. And I assumed that they did more games than they normally would have because of COVID. I just assumed they were like lived closest to the studio. Like, they were in the quarantine zone, so they could just, all right, just have those two duds do it again. That apparently was not it. They're both doing a lot of games again, except they have mixed in another electric personality, Ryan Sandberg.
What a trio.
I don't understand why you take the biggest introvert in Cub history and force him to try to talk to a camera. And they've done it. They tried it, WGN Radio tried it for a while. He did post-game for an entire year, and it was just terrible. NBC Sports Chicago tried it for a while. It's like, seems like a good idea until you have him do it. And then they're like, oh my God, this is terrible. Like, yeah, it's terrible.
They can have him do the pregame for when they replay the Sandberg game every time there's a rain delay or a rain on or something in the summer.
So they did a documentary last year on the Sandberg game, and it was fine. I mean, that is actually a lot of crazy shit happened in that game. It's a cool, you know, Willie McGahee hits for the cycle, and the Cubs get way behind and come back, and it was a fun game. But they were interspersing interviews with Ryan, current day Ryan, with it, and I had heard him. He tells the same three stories about the game for what is it now? 37 years. He's told the same stories. And so I literally, they could simply have cut to me and I could have told his stories. The first one is always going to be how in spring training that year, Jim Frey told him to stop to try to hit the bottom of the ball and get some lift instead of the top of the ball and hit the ball on the ground. It's like, okay, that story was mildly interesting in 1986. That story is not interesting 35 years later. You need a new story. Even if you just have to make shit up. You know, you get to the point, it's like, well, I was in a slump, so I was wearing ladies' underwear for the entire game. Now, that's, you would just make it up, but it would be more entertaining than the same shit that we keep hearing from him. So the Cubs are in the middle of a... basically, they squandered the easy beginning of their schedule. And now they're in a 22-game stretch where they have to play 7 games against the Braves. They've got the Mets. They are going to have the Dodgers here coming up. To the point where I looked at it, and this is, I was like, if they can just win 10 games, just go 10-12, just sniff 500 and survive this stretch, then things might be okay. And so far, they're actually playing a little bit ahead of that pace, which I guess is a good thing. And like we
that's
said,
a gripe of mine I have every year with the schedule. Like, yeah, they have their only two series with the Braves in the span of what, a week and a half,
yeah,
and then they play the fucking Brewers 9 times in their first 25 or 26 games or whatever it is. Like, you have 6 months of this. You know, you can spread these out a little bit. I'm actually this year, I think I'm fine getting all the Brewers games out of the way early.
Yeah, me too. Actually, I would be fine if they had a schedule every year where they just played the Cardinals the first 19 games of the year. I'd be cool with it. Just get that shit out of the way.
Yeah.
One team's always going to win 10. They're going to go 10-9 against each other. Just get it out of the way, and then I won't have to pay any attention to Yachty for the rest of the year. Just burn them off right away. This year, I think they're all backloaded. I think the second half of the season has a lot of Cardinal games in it, which... I don't have time for that.
It was a touching moment the other day in St. Louis when they had to pause the game after the first pitch to give Yachty a standing O for whatever it was.
He caught a pitch. He caught a pitch and they all gave him a standing ovation. Yeah, it was funny. So it was actually, you know, for the best fans in baseball, they cheered at the wrong time. What they were cheering was that was his 2,000th game behind the plate for the Cardinals. It's the most games caught by any player for one franchise ever. But they should have, if the Cardinals had been savvy, they should have cheered when he caught the first pitch of the 6th inning. The last pitch of their half of the 5th.
Yeah.
Because then the game would have been official. It's just like in the Ripken game. He didn't, like, run out on the field at the beginning of the game, and then they did the fireworks and shit. They waited until the game became official, and then he ran around the field and delayed the game for, like, a half hour. So, you know, these fans are so good, they should have known when to cheer.
Great point.
But actually, it was a setup. They, I don't remember who they were playing, but they had the bat. I think it was Washington. They had Trey Turner take the first pitch so that Yachty could catch it, and they could send that off to the Hall of Fame. Because I'm sure a lot of people are going to flock to the Hall of Fame to see the ball that Yachty caught in the 2000th game. That's, you know, get rid of all the Babe Ruth shit and just put that in a nice display.
So
Mike Donahue threw a fit on Twitter at the replay of the pitch. Because in it, Yachty he's going like full Josh Fegley. He's like got one knee on the ground. He's got his left knee is just up and it's completely exposed and he just catches the pitch. And Donahue's like, God, he's so lazy now, he can't even get in a squat and he's leaving his left leg open. We don't even let little league catchers do that. And it's like, he doesn't always set up like that. The whole plan was that pitch was just coming to him. Trey Turner was not going to follow the ball off of Yachty's thigh. Now, it would have been really funny if he had.
Oh,
and if I were
great.
Trey Turner, I would have. But yeah, it's like we can make fun of Yachty for a lot of shit, but I think it's probably okay. You know, he knew that he was just supposed to catch that one. I don't think it was that big a deal. So yeah, we should probably wrap this up. But looking around the Central, everybody's bunched pretty tightly. The Reds are the only team in the division with an offense, and they're only 9-6. The Brewers have by far the best pitching, and they're 11-7. But the Cardinals, the Cardinals and the Cubs, they're the same fucking team.
They really
are. As much
as
we hate them, they're the same. They are. Their pitching is a lot thinner than it should be, and their offense, they got a lot of outs in their lineups. And then there's those spunky Bucks. Pittsburgh has the same record going into tonight as the Cubs, which is actually not their plan because they're supposed to be tanking. But
they screwed up their tank, or MLB didn't do them any favors by giving them the Cubs six times in the first week and a half.
But I think it was 2016. The Pirates were in second place behind the Cubs for a really good stretch of the first half, and then may have finished with the worst record in the National League. The Pirates know when to turn it on. When it's time to lose 35 out of 40, the Pirates know how to do that. They're not worried about it. The 7-9 start, they're like, no, we got it. Don't worry about it. We're not even going to win a game in July. We're not worried about it. We're going to have our pick of Vanderbilt pitchers this year and next because we're going to have the worst record in baseball.
Just gotta let them do the thing. Gotta let it play out. The Brewers pitching. I mean, I think unfortunately the Brewers might be the odds-on favorite to win the division right now, and you could probably make a case they have the best roster, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the pitching is awesome, but like, are they gonna let these guys go more than five innings, six innings, whatever this year? Are they still? I don't know.
I kind of joked about it, but I didn't. So obviously Devin Williams was amazing last year. Had one of the best, and I even hesitate to call it seasons because the season was so short. They only played 60 games, but he pitched 27 innings in 22 games. He gave up one run. He struck out 53 guys in 27 innings and allowed 8 hits. It was ridiculous. I mean, that's about as dominant as you can get. But they had to shut him down late in the season because he had a shoulder injury. He didn't pitch in the postseason. They had him start late in spring training. And then the Cubs played the Pirates in the first series. I forget who the Brewers played, but he didn't pitch in that first series. I guess it was the Twins. Then he pitched a couple of times against the Cubs and was bad. And he has been bad. He has pitched. He's still only pitched in 5 games. So 2 of those, 3 of those, I think, against the Cubs with no offense. And so he walked 9 guys in 27 innings last year. He's walked 5 in 4 2/3. He gave up one earned run last year. He's already given up 4. And he has already given up half as many hits this season as he did all last season. So there's a good chance that there's something wrong with him. And
yeah, he could very well be fine, but it's crazy. Like, Brewers fans being surprised by that, it's probably the most highly volatile position in baseball. Relief pitching. I mean, they've seen it themselves, so it really shouldn't come as a surprise. No. But a guy that throws like that with that kind of stuff. I mean, especially when you toss an injury in there, it's not super surprising.
But it's funny. It's one of the things we've come across on Remember This Crap when we go season by season is we already remembered you take that 60 game schedule last year, and Devin was amazing for those 60 games. Like, Carlos Marmol, 2 seasons in a row, had stretches longer than that, where he was every bit that amazing. Kyle Farnsworth had a year where, for 2 months, he was unhittable. That's not that unusual. It's the idea that none of those guys ever played in a season, though, where those 60 games were the whole year. And everybody's like, oh my God, we have this revelation. He's great. It could have been that had last year been a full season, that, yes, Devin Williams has 2 months where he's amazing, and then, but he might have 4 months where he's pretty good. And his numbers are a lot more normal for a relief pitcher. Actually, that's almost assuredly what would have happened. But this whole idea that he's just going to roll into 2021 and they're going to have him and Hader and the last, you know, at least 6 outs, maybe 9 outs of every game are just taken care of, that's just not how it's going to work.
No.
But what they do have is they have almost assuredly the two best starting pitchers in the division.
And they've got
three good ones, and then they've obviously they have a legit closer, as much as everybody finds Josh Hader icky. He really is good. Their offense isn't great, but yeah, they probably are. I would think I don't know what to make of the Reds. So Milwaukee probably is the best team in the division. It's not the Cubs or the Cardinals.
No, definitely.
And I just Nolan Arenado's been okay, but he was a gift to them. The Cardinals would be even worse than this if the Rockies hadn't been like, here, take him, and here's $50 million. Just, we don't want him. Take him.
Absurd.
All right, so so the Cubs continue on this in their stretch of playing difficult teams. At least they're scoring a run or two.
Nice helps.
Yeah. Scored 14 tonight, so that's kind of nice. I was really sure that when they had the huge bust out on Saturday, that felt like one of those. We get 14 run. We get 13 runs on Saturday, and then we score a total of 12 runs over the next 9 games.
Oh, absolutely.
That really felt like that was going to happen, and it hasn't. So that's a good sign.
But, I mean, that's the thing. Like, they're going to have days like that on Saturday when they hit a bunch of homers, or nights like tonight, I guess, where they somehow score. They might even have a decent amount of these days, but like the valleys in between those peaks are going to be... I mean, last night, I think they had 3 hits last night when they won?
Yeah. Yeah, they needed the Mets to throw the ball all over the field to win. But for the most part, other than a blowout here or there, their pitching's been good enough that if they just scratch across a few runs, you know, they're in these games. So, I don't know. It's the thing about it is there's nothing worse to watch than your team not be able to hit. Mm-hmm. There's nothing duller than 3 hours of the team you're rooting for doing nothing. You'd almost rather, if you had to pick it, it's like, all right, I would much rather, if we're not going to be good, and we can only be good on an offense or pitching, give me a good offense with a bad pitching staff, because those games will be more fun to watch than this. So, we'll see what happens. All right.
Well, they have the rest of, I got Atlanta again next week, and then the Brewers for the 100th time in a month.
Yeah, well, the good thing about Atlanta is it looks everybody got hurt during the Cubs series, so maybe they could just stay hurt long enough that they're not back yet. Because Ozzie Albies, I mean, for his career, I think he hits .889 against the Cubs. So
that's all, that checks out.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Kyle.
Cool. Thank you, Andy.
So we will catch up here in the next couple of weeks probably and see how things are going.
But, another exciting check-in.
Yeah, I mean, this they're at least showing signs of waking up, which is nice because it's an awful long season to be bad. You know, if you're going to be bad, at least be interesting.
Yeah, keep us in for a little bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time.
Yep. Thanks, Andy.
Many of us have herpes.